Great are the works of the Lord. They are pondered by all who delight in them. I was delighted when I heard that the theme of this year's conference was hearing the voice of God in nature. For what could be more appropriate and more important to a discussion of science and faith than that central desire of the Christian life to hear God's voice? Yet when we listen for God's voice in nature, we find, if we are honest, that the witness to God is deeply ambiguous. Now, you might not notice this ambiguity if your full exposure to nature was the sort of thing that is usually put up on church PowerPoints or brought out in Christian hymnody. All things bright and beautiful is fine, but look beyond calendar pictures and urban gardens, and you find amongst the works of the Lord things that can be deeply disturbing. So I want to take you to three moments tonight where the ambiguity of nature was especially evident to me. In the first moment, I woke up suddenly, and this is what I saw. It is completely black, and it takes me a moment to remember where I am. I'm in the middle of the Rocky Mountains in a tent in the middle of the night, and just as I get oriented, I realize what it was that woke me up outside of my tent. Some large and unknown creature is meeting its end. Shrieks ring out through the night and then stop with intimidating finality. The silence is only broken by the sound of tearing skin and snapping bones. And while I'm sitting there hoping that my all too thin tent walls will mask the smell of fear, no doubt, emanating from me, I'm struck by the thought that this event is no exception, no special horror. This is the regular course of nature, now brought uncomfortably close. Every wild carnivore I have ever rejoiced to see has survived by making this a daily reality. The second moment happened several years later, on the shores of paradise. On a small island off the coast of Vancouver, my friends have the world's best home. Every wall is lined with obscure and fascinating books, and the overstocked kitchen is always just moments away from a feast. And it is also just a short walk down to the stunning beach. But one spring when I visited, a particular phenomenon overshadowed the usually glorious experience. The orchard trees, usually covered with fresh growth, were covered with something else. People on the geology trip today will have a bit of a preview for what this is. It's hard to see in this picture, but we're going to zoom in on one of these clumps. Tent caterpillars, in their millions, had emerged to devour every leaf in sight. They decimated all greenery, reducing the rich landscape to something that belongs in a horror film. So numerous were the caterpillars that they devoured everything faster than new growth could emerge. So the trees, severely damaged, produced no fruit that year. The farmers were left without. And nearly every species suffered by this explosion of population, including the caterpillars themselves, who by and large starved to death. One species, however, did rather well. If you look closely at the caterpillars, nearly every second one had a little white dot somewhere on their forehead. See some nodding heads, you know it's coming. This was an egg laid by the Ichneumonidae wasp, and the wasps lay their eggs on living caterpillars, and when they hatch, the larvae burrow into the body and thereby have a large supply of fresh food waiting defenselessly to be devoured. So in case you ever wondered where the producers of the movie Alien got their idea of the face sucker from, it wasn't actually from something alien at all. It came from nature. Now, the third story is from a ranch I used to work on in Alberta. So the horse further away is named Jigs, and the closer one is Jesse, two wonderfully powerful and beautiful Belgians who pulled our wagons and sleighs for many years. One summer evening, however, there was a terrible windstorm. And this is tornado country, so the winds could be serious business. And when the next morning we went out into the pasture to check on the horses, we found to our great dismay that part of a tree had fallen on Jessie and severely broken one of her legs. The marks on the ground around her showed that she had thrashed around in agony for hours before we found her, lying exhausted, and were able to put her out of her pain. Three stories of nature's ambiguity: predation, parasitism, and horrific accident. These are, as often as not, what we hear when we listen to the voice of nature. And it is in precisely these complexities that we will listen tonight for the voice of God. Can this really be the very good world of a loving God? Our biological sciences tend to only make the problem worse. So while William Paley could confidently assert in 1802 that it is a happy world after all, evolutionary theory makes the voice of God more difficult because it points to the disvalues, the death, the predation, and the violence as the very source of evolutionary development. Now, before delving into the various theological accounts of violence in nature, it's helpful to refine the picture just a little bit. Not everything that causes pain is bad. Not every disvalue is something that we would rather do without. So, first of all, pain itself is a great and necessary good for mobile creatures. The horror of leprosy is that it eliminates the ability to feel pain. So those with Hansen's disease then unintentionally destroy their own bodies because they cannot feel the effect that their actions have. Or sometimes they simply can't protect themselves well from the world around, as was the case in one African clinic where rats came and ate off patients' fingers while they slept because they didn't feel anything. They didn't wake up and defend themselves. So without pain, we would live diminished lives. And interestingly, if what some of the people who Jesus encountered had was actually Hansen's disease and not simply another skin disease, then Jesus' healing involved restoring their ability to feel pain, restoring pain to them. So when we look more closely, we find that many of the things we would initially object to, pain, predation, natural disasters, and so on, are actually necessary for a good and flourishing world. So our concern in this talk is not with the fact that there is pain or that natural disasters occur, but with the competitive, violent, and seemingly useless suffering and waste that pervades the process of evolutionary development. Why have a system that relies upon the predation of the weak and the vulnerable? Why develop life through a process that means countless animals fall victim to accident, as Jessie did? The values inherent in the natural world seem totally at odds with the God of Scripture, the God who chooses mercy and love and advocates that others do the same. So I am going to try and persuade you this evening that when we listen to nature's violence, when we observe the painfulness and competitive evolutionary processes full of contingents, we can hear God's affirmation that the world is tov meod, very good. This may not be popular, but that's okay. Martin Luther said, sin boldly, then repent boldly. So I have a whole weekend forward where you guys can help me think through what I get wrong in this. Now, since the time of the Reformation, the usual way to account for the violence and suffering in creation, in the non-human world, was simply to chalk it up to the effects of the human fall. Calvin could say, for it appears that all the evils of the present life, which experience proves to be innumerable, have proceeded from the same fountain. The inclemency of air, frost, thunders, unseasonable rains, drought, hail, and whatever is disorderly in the world are the fruits of sin, nor is there any other primary cause of diseases. Centuries later, in 1868, Charles Spurgeon said, creation glows with 1,000 beauties, even in its present fallen condition. Yet clearly enough, it is not as it was when it came from its maker's hand. The slime of the serpent is on it all. This is not the world which God pronounced to be very good. It is a sad, sad world. The curse has fallen on it since the fall, and thorns and thistles it bringeth forth, not from its soil alone, but from all that comes from it. For the English-speaking world, shaped as much by the poetry of Milton as by the biblical text or the theological tradition, associating the human fall with the non-human violence has become an integrated part of the Christian story, traced through creation, fall, and redemption. Yet discoveries in the late 18th century and throughout the 19th and 20th centuries cast a shadow on this simple approach. Discoveries have shown over and over again that extinction and violence have been intrinsic to the natural living world long before humans existed. Darwin added to the increasingly grim picture by showing that the competitive and ruthless elimination of life was a primary mechanism in developing endless forms most beautiful. So the familiar story that everything was perfect until sin in the garden marred it does not stand either chronologically or biologically. Some attempts to preserve human fault have been made, most notably by William Dembski in his retroactive application of the effects of the fall on the early earth. However, such attempts are riddled with theological difficulty. Not only are they sweepingly anthropocentric, but also biblically problematic. God's report of a very good creation becomes wholly fictional, for by their account, God created the world in this original corruption. So where else can we look for an explanation? Well, since humans came too late to the story, a growing group of theologians have opted for a satanic origin for evolution's ambiguity. Michael Lloyd, Paul Griffiths, Nathan O'Halloran, and Gregory Boyd are some of those advocating this view. The most famous defender of this position, C.S. Lewis, speculated that perhaps it was only the planet Earth that was fallen and not the whole cosmos. But either way, the evolutionary process was deeply marred. Parasites should never have threatened the flourishing of other creatures, and predation and accidents should not cut short the life of animals in their prime. Nonetheless, the Christian who takes this view is faced again with serious questions biblically and theologically. Biblically, if the world has fallen before humans evolve, where is the scriptural evidence of a satanic corruption in earth or sky or sea? Gregory Boyd would protest that corruption is mentioned and that the struggle between God and oppositional forces is reflected in Old Testament passages where God rebukes the hostile waters of the deep or fights sea monsters. So a good example of this is Psalm 89. You rule over the surging sea. When its waves mount up, you still them. You crushed Rahab like one of the slain. With your strong arm, you scattered your enemies. And so Boyd claims about this, a very real battle took place when God created the world and is still taking place as Yahweh and not Baal or Marduk preserves the world from chaos. And the problem is that the sea, the dragons in the waters, and the Leviathan only ever appear as already defeated enemies in the Bible. They're not only defeated, but they fail to even put up any kind of resistance to God's attack. So Rebecca Watson notes this. It appears that although Leviathan and Rahab are sometimes portrayed as recipients of Yahweh's antagonism, the lack of resistance or even acknowledged provocation or hostility precludes speaking of combat proper. There is no indication that there is any sort of an ongoing struggle with them. Similarly, Boyd's claim that these hymns express the author's perception that the cosmos is besieged at a structural level with forces of evil that God himself must battle is simply not borne out by the biblical content. Everywhere the total victory of God over chaotic forces and creatures is announced, proclaimed, and celebrated, And where the chaotic forces or sea creatures do appear as currently existing, they are universally seen as one of God's good creatures, or well within the boundaries of God's current control. So although these Leviathan or Tananim were enemies of the order of creation in ancient Near Eastern mythology, in Genesis, they make up part of a very good world. In Genesis 1:21, the great sea creatures are simply named along with the rest of those whom Elohim creates. In Psalm 104, the Leviathan that God formed frolics in the sea. And yes, the Hebrew word for frolic is just as lovely as the English one. The character of Satan is noticeably absent in the creation stories, and God alone is the creator. And so even if we take Psalm 89, which Boyd uses in context, we read after the story of the battle that the heavens are yours, and yours also the earth. You founded the world and all that is in it. I mean, the whole of the divine dialogues in Job are an eloquent attribution of all the most problematic parts of the creation to God's handiwork, from carnivorous birds and giant sea monsters to hail and whirlwinds. And if there are biblical questions about a satanic corruption of the earth, there are also important theological objections. Maintaining God as the creator is an important aspect of Christian belief, but if the evolutionary process was not God's intention, if God never intended violence, to what do we attribute the beauties that emerge out of that violence? Holmes Rolston has poetically written, "The cougar's fang has carved the limbs of the fleet-footed deer, and vice versa." If God did not intend the fang, if the fang is the result of satanic corruption, can we meaningfully attribute the beauty of the deer to God? It would seem that Satan is the origin of both. Now, throughout the natural world, we can find countless examples of the renewal and innovation brought about by the realities that these theologians would attribute to satanic forces. So whether forest fires, predators, even parasites contribute to the integrated flourishing of ecosystems. Too much of nature's creativity would be attributed to Satan through this approach. So let us lay it aside for now. There are other explanations for creation's violence as well, most of which revolve around denying the ability of God to rightly order creation. So Thomas Ord takes the radical option of denying creatio ex nihilo, or creation out of nothing, because he prefers an idea of creation out of chaos. Celia Dean Drummond advocates a shadow sophia, or anti-wisdom, that is like a shadow cast by creation's light. Neil Messer defends a Barthian prehistory fallenness, and Nicola Hogarth-Cregan simply asserts that the world is mysteriously and ubiquitously touched by evil. Each of these, in one way or another, deny God's achievement in creation. God wanted one thing, straw-eating lions or venomous adders, perhaps, but could only achieve carnivorous lions and fanged snakes. These mysterious fallenness models do not help us in our quest to hear the voice of God in creation. They simply state that the voice of God is hopelessly muddled. Evil happens, and there's no explanation that will satisfy. Now, let me say, an admission of mystery is, of course, the final step that every theodicy takes, including mine. But I wonder if there's not still a little more listening to do at this point. So, where shall we go with this troublesome problem of the violence in nature? We cannot look to human sin. We cannot look to angelic fault. We do not yet want to turn to mystery. I suggest that we look back at our question. Can this world of blood, fire, and fang really be the very good creation of a loving God? The sticking point is not the concept of God. Human cultures have constructed many gods with whom the very often vicious character of nature would rest at ease. But the problem is that Christianity describes God both as the creator and as a God of infinite love. So the violence of the world is only a surprise in light of the second of these. If God were uncaring, we would find little wrong with the world. Wesley Wildman, a notable voice in this conversation, takes just such an approach. God, according to Wildman, is the fecund source of all events, regardless of whether human standards in play at a particular time would classify them as good, bad, or indifferent. He continues, God is not in the caring business. But if we are going to talk about a God of love, it's worth investigating what we mean by the term. Love is easily one of the most abused words in the English vocabulary. So we can love our family and love our favorite TV show. Love can be an expression of the highest aspiration of the human soul, or it can be an advertising slogan for hamburgers. So what do we mean by it? Well, most people would mean something along the lines of a strong emotion in response to something that's valued. I love him because he makes me laugh. But if our love is entirely responsive, what happens when accident impairs or when someone funnier comes along? If love is solely the response to value, it would lack faithfulness in light of change, and that doesn't resound with us as what love should be. I would not particularly want to be loved by someone who abandoned me the moment I lost the qualities that they valued. Responding to this difficulty, a different approach has been taken that says love exists entirely within the volition of the lover. So we might value her because she is funny and I love her, but I love her because I choose to and choose to act accordingly. Well, this explains the faithfulness of love in terms of change. It still does leave a problem, and Eleanor Stump points this out, that if the beloved ever asked, well, why do you love me? The person who loves by a volitional account would have to reply, well, it has nothing to do with you. Maybe it's not such a great definition after all. So Stump instead develops a definition of love based on Thomas Aquinas' work, love as the outcome of two desires. First, the desire for the good of the beloved, and second, the desire for union with the beloved. So if we desire the good of an individual, it has to be responsive to the particular needs of that individual and their own capacity for flourishing. Likewise, the type of union desired will be dependent on the relationship we hold with him or her. So love's union will be different depending on whether I love a parent, a spouse, a child, or a friend. So exploring somebody's body might be one appropriate expression of love, while playing a game of ball might be another in a different sort of relationship. And so you have different relationships mediated by different sorts of love. Skilled musicians can share a particular relationship that is closed to the non-musical, for example. So love has to do with particular people in response to their particular skills and identity. And what is interesting about this definition of love is that anything that has a good, anything that can exist in relationship, can be a proper object of love. So I could legitimately love my dog, but less legitimately love my cheeseburger. I'm sorry, Mr. Lunt, if any of you guys were VeggieTales fans. Now, applied to God, this notion of love is really quite interesting. First, since it is responsive to the particular good of the beloved and the appropriate relationship of union, it will always be particular. It's never sort of a universal blanket love. So if God loves the world, God loves individuals within the world, both human and non-human. Second, since the two desires of love reside in the lover, love can be unilateral and unrequited. So the objects of love do not have to be creatures who can return God's love. They just need to have a good that God can desire. God can love worms as well as humans by this definition, by desiring the good of worms and by desiring the appropriate relationship with the worm. And that would no doubt be a wormish sort of love and perhaps not open to human investigation. But the concept gives new meaning to the idea that God so loved the cosmos, the whole world, that he gave his only begotten Son. Humans are not the only beneficiaries of God's love and are not the sole arbiters of the purpose of creation, an important message in itself in our time of ecological crisis. What else can we say about this love of God for creation? W.H. Vanstone, in his short masterpiece, Love's Endeavor, Love's Expense, defines the boundaries of love through three phenomenological markers. So he says, if limitation, control, and detachment are present, he argues, then love is not. So first, limitation. If God loves the world, then regardless of the outcomes or cost, God must commit to the project of creation without hesitation and without calculation. Limitlessness means that God will never turn away from the creation. No amount of disvalue, pain, or even of rebellion will turn God away from desiring the good of creatures and the fulfillment of creation in union with God. So God does not simply create the world and leave it to its own devices, but accompanies creation, suffering with those who suffer and rejoicing with those who rejoice. God's love is limitless. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Rather like being a parent, one would think. We might think accompanying the creation is a rather weak response to the suffering of countless creatures. What does it help if God suffers with those who suffer, if God does not prevent their suffering in the first place? Well, first of all, it avoids one of the most profound mistakes we can make about God. So many imagine God to be a little bit like Lord Farquaad from the movie Shrek. Do you remember him? When he wanted to send knights on the very dangerous mission to rescue the Princess Fiona, he stood high above them in a balcony, and he said, "Some of you may die, but that is a risk I am willing to take." Without some sense that God suffers alongside creation, we risk seeing God as the one who makes others simple means to an end. But that is not the way of love. That is not the way of the God who is most fully revealed in the crucified Christ. But I'm getting ahead to myself. We'll get back to Christology. Vanstone's second mark of inauthentic love is the mark of control. Vanstone writes, when one who professes to love is wholly in control of the object of his love, then the falsity of love is exposed. We cannot both love and control, because love necessarily involves respect for the will and being of the other, since these are intrinsic goods. I desire the good, I can't transgress their intrinsic goods. Think of a parent and child. If you notice a child who is never allowed to make decisions, never allowed to take risks, never allowed to make mistakes, do you really come to the conclusion that this child is deeply loved? Or do you think, as I do, that the priorities of love have somehow been misplaced? The principles for God and the non-human world are no different than parent and child. For God to control the creation entirely would be to determine and therefore destroy its capacity to develop self-being insofar as it possesses that capacity. It is good for the creation to be itself. So if God loves the creation, God will not control and thereby diminish its being. For Australian theologian Dennis Edwards, God's respect for creaturely autonomy is most fully expressed in the event of the cross, where God chooses to suffer the rejection of God's own creation and so reveal the full extent of divine love. Instead of overwhelming or coercing, Jesus accepts the limited understanding and love of people, even when they crucify him. Through the cross, God's nature is revealed. And this nature, writes Edwards, is revealed in the Christ event as radical, self-giving love. This is a divine and transcendent love, a love that has an unimaginable capacity to respect the autonomy and independence of creatures, to work with them patiently, and to bring all things to their fulfillment. God's way of dealing with sin was not to arrive in overwhelming triumph and slay all evildoers. God's way was to lay crucified while slain by evildoers. And here is the difference. While the first way would have brought an end to those who do evil, the second way redeems them. And it is the same with the whole of creation. God's methods are slow, precarious, and unpredictable. They work with rather than against the beloved, even when that is costly. And in this sense, the precarious journey of evolutionary wanderings fit well with our view of how divine love would create. Life emerges slowly, fragile yet surprisingly robust. Mass extinction events threaten the possibility of life over and over again, yet each time life responds with more creative diversity than before. And through it all, God does not overwhelm or interrupt, but lovingly accompanies creation, even as it develops methods of survival that do not yet reflect God's character. The final mark of inauthentic love, according to Vanstone, is that of detachment. A lover who is untouched by the trials of the beloved does not actually love. In our definition of love, God's vulnerability is seen in the desire for certain outcomes for the beloved, for the good of the beloved. If God has desires for creatures, which love necessarily implies, and creatures can resist those desires, then God cannot be unaffected by creation. Now, for many Christians, the conclusion of vulnerability has been troublesome since it challenges the notion of God's aseity and God's immutability. That is, God's ability to be totally self-existent, self-reliant, and unchanging. If God responds to the world, then the world has the power to affect God beyond God's own choice. And this is problematic. After all, it appears as if there would be nothing to prevent God from being overwhelmed by suffering, just as people often are. Paul Fides, along with Dennis Edwards and Walter Casper, find a middle way between refusing God the ability to suffer altogether and refusing the uncontrollable nature of suffering by suggesting that God chooses that suffering should befall him. God chooses to be vulnerable and chooses to be open to the suffering that love brings. Fides's conclusion coheres well with Vanstone's observation that where love is authentic, the lover gives to the object of his love a certain power over himself, a power which would not otherwise be there. Of itself, the creation has no power to affect God. In this sense, God is immutable and impassible. Yet, as an object of love, creation gains the power to affect God because God gives himself to it. Yet, since the ability to suffer is freely chosen by God, God is not ruled or overwhelmed by it. Suffering remains both uncaused by God and voluntary. Now, the second and third marks of love, those of precariousness and vulnerability, mean something very important when we're trying to listen for the voice of God. They tell us that we can know the whole cosmos is loved precisely because the creation does not look like God. Let me unpack that a bit. A facile notion of love would assume that a good creation would be one that perfectly reflects God in every respect. If God is perfect and peaceable, then a beloved creation should be perfect and peaceable too, right? It makes sense. And we see this all the time in daily life. After all, if a parent is perfectly tidy, then a profoundly loved teenager's room will obviously be tidy as well. Right? Maybe not. So the paradox of the loving parent is that they allow the teen to eat junk food or keep an untidy room, or become a vegetarian, or as my parents had to do, allow one to take up sword fighting as a hobby, because the young adult self-development, their selving, to borrow a term from Christopher Southgate, is more important than the gains that could be made by close control. The paradox of the loving God is that God allows creation to grow up on its own terms as well. Sometimes beautiful and peaceable and cooperative, sometimes violent and full of suffering. Vanstone puts the paradox this way: the external restraint which love practices is often a mark of its freedom from internal limit. So, when we listen for the voice of God's love in nature, we may find that God's voice is clearest in the places that initially seem most at odds with God's love. An omnipotent God could create a nature that perfectly expressed the Trinitarian interpersonal peace, but it would only be a mirror or a photograph, a static reflection of God's own being. And an omnipotent God could do that, but only a loving God would create a self-developing world marked by radical freedom. And that freedom is not an end in itself. It's not free just to be free. It is free so it can develop into something that does resemble God, but by dynamic imitation rather than by static reflection. The intuition we have that a creation made by the God of peace should be peaceable is not wrong. It's only that we're meeting the world in mid-development, in adolescence, so to speak. When we listen to the voice of God in nature, we can't hear the clarion call of perfection achieved. We hear the whispered promise of what is yet to come. And there is abundant evidence of the struggle of growth, the competition and violence. There's also evidence reflecting peace and altruism. So Sarah Coakley and Martin Novak have highlighted in their recent work the importance of cooperation and symbiosis in evolutionary development. Still, we can't rely on this cooperation too far, since cooperation in nature is usually always for the survival of the newly formed alliance against other alliances. So it'd be a little like portraying human cooperation in gangs as an example of human altruism. Doesn't quite work. Yet, it is cooperation, but it's only for greater strength. But it is helpful to see that violence and death are not the only creative forces in nature. Symbiosis, cooperation, altruism have their place as well. Now, the most profound reflection of God in the world is seen, paradoxically, also in the one place in creation where the world truly is fallen, truly is not as it should be in human beings. And here we run into yet another problem. If I'm saying that the world, apart from humans, is as it should be, if the evolutionary process is not corrupted in its violence, competition, and accident, how can I say that it is a problem when it occurs in humans? Why are humans any different? What makes it not sinful for a chimpanzee to kill another, as they often do, but the same action in humans is sinful? Well, it comes down, I think, to what the purpose of each part of creation is. So I would suggest that God's ultimate purpose in creation is to form autonomous beings who can be loved by God and who have the capacity to learn to love. My thinking in this area has been profoundly shaped by Andrew Elphinstone and his book Freedom, Suffering, and Love. And in it, Elphinstone suggests that while evolution can produce the raw ingredients needed for love, evolution cannot produce love in beings. And if that is the case, then the evolutionary process is suitable for producing all sorts of creatures who can be loved by God, and it can produce all sorts of desires in those creatures. And if we link up Elphinstone's insight with Stump and Aquinas' definition of love as a composite desire, we can begin to see or create a coherent picture. So evolution can produce desire. In fact, it produces all sorts of desires, whether for security or self-sustenance, for reproduction, evolution's desires are like wheat in the field. Love, however, is more like bread, the result of careful cultivation, a work that uses what nature provides and transforms it into something else. In humans, the free evolutionary process provides us with desires that await a further work of God in our soul. So in God's work, work that is beyond nature, our desires are formed into the likeness of Christ and his love. Our society tends to think, or tends to express, that what is natural is good. We are encouraged to find our true selves by uncovering our most basic nature. But the Christian calling is one to unnatural virtue, to desires transformed by Christ. And so the natural is an intrinsic part of that, of course. Not even the most skilled baker can make bread without flour. But to confuse the raw ingredients for the finished product would be a very grave mistake indeed. Since the work of transforming natural desires into the desires of love is something only humans have the capacity for, only humans are accountable for resisting that particular work of God. So when a chimpanzee attacks another, it's following its natural desires, and in doing so, is living as a part of God's good world. When a human acts on those same instincts and desires, he or she is denying the love that God would work in them. We've been trying to tease out how a God of love could create a world of violence and strife. And so far, I've suggested several partial solutions. First, that the love God bears for creation requires a certain level of freedom to be given so that creation can be itself. Second, that where the freedom causes suffering, God suffers with those creatures, bearing the tragic cost of a risky endeavor. And finally, I suggested that as a method of creating beings who hold strong desires that could provide the raw ingredients of the strong desires of love, evolution is actually a very effective method. Well, all this is well and good, but it's still not enough. There are still situations where the benefits seem completely outweighed by the cost. Lives cut short by accident or neglect, lives that carry little but suffering and pain, defy our attempts to justify them through greater good arguments. And we need to see some sort of redemption for those who suffer. So J. McDaniel outlines four different types of redemption. First, redemption as the freedom from the consequences of sin. Second, freedom from what distresses or harms. Third, redemption as a contribution to the lives beyond one's own. And lastly, transformation into a new type of being. Now, not all of these models of redemption are equally applicable to the non-human world. The first, freedom from sin, applies almost exclusively to humans, though in our ecological crisis, it may have some wider implications as well. While freedom from distress or harm is surely a form of redemption, it's fairly weak on its own, since it might mean no more than the death of the creature who suffers. So Jesse, that magnificent horse whose story I told you earlier, was freed from her distress when we found her, but one can hardly call that redemption. But the third meaning, contribution to the life of others, finally begins to gain some traction. At one level, we know that the creatures who die are not wasted. Rather, their bodies are eaten and the substance of their lives passed into those around them. Every new life depends on the death of those who came before. And the death of the individual is not just a help to those who consume them, but also to their own species. So deer are fleet-footed precisely because many who were slow were devoured by hungry cougars. But many times in the history of life, the whole have benefited because of the death of the individual. So life builds upon life and life upon death. And every creature is caught up in the exchange. Every creature receives contributions from others and contributes to others. And more than that, every creature contributes to the life of God. And some theologians have made much of the joy brought to God through the existence of being of each creature, how each creature is eternally kept in the memory of God, and this is a form of redemption. Still, it doesn't quite seem to be enough. For too many, life is truly solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. The classic example in the literature is McDaniel's white pelican chick. Now, white pelicans lay 2 eggs in every year with the strategy of only raising 1 chick. So in over 90% of the cases, it is the first chick who lives. When the second and smaller chick is hatched, the older sibling pushes it from the nest, where the parents ignore its plaintive cries until its inevitable demise. In about 10% of the cases, the first chick dies and the second is raised in its place. And this ensures that in every reproductive cycle, a chick is raised. While it might be a viable species survival technique, the second chick's life seems to be all tragedy and no triumph. So what is the response of love to this creature? How can a God of love allow this? And what would redemption look like for that second chick? Increasingly, theologians are moving towards McDaniel's fourth option, redemption as the transformation into a new type of being. McDaniel himself calls the idea pelican heaven. Pelican heaven, or horse heaven in Jesse's case, is the theological hypothetical postulated as love's response to creatures whose lives have known the cost of evolution. So people have always wondered about the final end of non-humans, and throughout most of the tradition, it's been denied because it thought that human or non-human creatures didn't have the internal capacity to bear eternal beings. They didn't have eternal souls. But as people have moved more towards a Hebrew view of life, that there are nephesh, that people are living beings, and it's not this soul and body duality. If you have an integrated view of being, then that disappears because there's not a big difference between human and non-human forms of life. So several theologians have suggested that non-human animals will only be present in the new creation if they were connected somehow to humans. So pets, for example, would be included in redemption because of their particular relationship to their owners. Of dinosaurs, however, there would be few. And this seems to me not only sad, because I love dinosaurs, but far too anthropocentric, far too human-focused. Redemption is God's idea. And some other theologians have speculated that the existence in the new creation would be based on the capacity and actuality of suffering in the life of the individual. So creatures included would have to be A, sentient enough to suffer, and B, would have to have drawn the short straw in their earthly life. Creatures who have flourished would not need redemption. But this, I think, is to confuse redemption with compensation. So redemption might involve compensation, but it should not be reducible to it. Theologically speaking, I think that God's love for all creatures is the very strongest argument for the redemption of all creatures. The great Christological hymn in Colossians 1 says, "For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. All things, we are told, are reconciled to God through Christ." So reconciliation and redemption can not only extend to sinful humans, but must reach beyond them. We have explored various different options this evening, ways to hear the voice of God in the violence of nature. And the voice, what redemption tells us, is that the voice of God, whispered and muffled now through the glories and the tragedies of nature, will one day ring out clearly. the ambiguity that we hear now in the voice of nature one day will be solved, and love will be and always has been its theme. Thank you.
For a couple minutes. Does anybody have a question? Dr. Miller.
Can you come up and use the microphone, please? Yeah. We have our people on live streaming who need to be able to hear as well.
Yes.
Thank you.
You got me on a slide far back having to do with your definition of love. And it was... Can I go back that far? Can you flip back to the slides?
Yep.
See how...
We had... This one? Hang on.
Yes, exactly. The desire for the good of the beloved can be read two ways. I can desire that the beloved have good, or I can desire that the good the beloved has is mine. Which way is it is meant?
The first.
Okay.
Yeah, that they have their good.
Thanks.
Although it's interesting because there's a way in which if you love them, the achievement of their good becomes the lover's own good.
Yeah.
So it becomes integrated. Yeah.
To what extent should we leave God's creation alone, and to what extent should we tinker with it to make it better? Overcome death so we can live forever, or the other extreme, but physician assisted suicide. That's just one example.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a great question. And the first thing is that to say how far should we leave God's creation alone is an impossible question because we're already part of it. There's actually the nature-human divide is one that's sort of artificial. It doesn't really exist. So, you know, if we're talking about medical enhancements, we have certain things that are normal in our culture that, you know, beyond which we would consider an enhancement. But a long time ago, cooking would have been an unnatural enhancement that helped life a great deal, or other things that we do. Air conditioning when you're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? So... how do we decide even what is or is not is a big question in itself. From my talk tonight, one of the things that I would bring out if I had a longer time was that death in itself is not the enemy. Death with sin is the enemy. And so I would resist the idea that humans should, for example, try to live forever through medical means. That seems to me a deep denial of our creaturely being, and it denies the possibility and the hope of redemption as well. This is not the end. And so it's a huge issue, and so if I'll give a very short answer with that and hope you're satisfied. We can talk later. There's a cue.
When did people first start considering animal death to be a theological problem?
That's an interesting question. Largely, I think it happened around the time of the Reformation. So if you read the earliest, you know, church fathers and stuff, Augustine has no problem with animal death. He had a problem with human death. So he said humans should have lived forever in the garden. But of course animals eat each other. What else would you want? There seems to be a change in the period of the Reformation where that thinking changes and where the initial creation was perfectly peaceable. You want to come back?
Maybe it just got cushy for us.
Oh, maybe it just... Oh, okay. All right.
I've got the same question. I wonder if Disney has anthropomorphized animals so that we that live in the cities and aren't in the rural areas have taken animals to something that they really aren't in creation initially. And you know, we can blame Disney, but we can blame other things. But my question is the same kind of one. As we look back in history, where did animals and the feelings of animals come into play? Why not talk about the feelings of plants? I mean, why pick on animals? I'm serious about that, because animals is just an animal, so what?
Well, yeah, so the big question is, do non-human animals suffer? I mean, we are animals ourselves. If you look at the classification in Linnaeus, we come under Animalia. We are creatures in that sense, and animals. So the question has been, do non-human animals suffer? And in fact, one of my examples wasn't a particularly great one, because those caterpillars probably didn't suffer at all from being eaten alive from the inside. It's something that we respond to with horror, but you know, they just sort of go on their daily life. And so not every instance of these things are suffering, and I think that's why we're not so worried about plants, because we don't think that they suffer. But when you get to the higher mammals particularly, you see all the same physiological responses and even psychological responses that we have, and I think we have to take that seriously.
I have kind of the opposite question of the previous two.
Okay.
And that is, you rightly point out that satanic corruption is problematic to attribute these evolutionary processes to. But what do we do, where does satanic fall of angels fit within this larger cosmology? Because in that case, it's not even ambiguous. You know, in scripture it says these angels are thrown into the fire to be punished eternally. So here we have like created intelligences, presumably, that there's no question about the suffering involved, and that this is part of a creative process. So where would you fit that in terms of the cosmology?
That is a great question, and my answer is I don't know, very confidently.
I want you to reconcile the lion laying down with the lamb in the new redemption with the fact in the new redemption a chimp kills another chimp.
Okay, so that's a great question. So what do we do with these visions of a peaceable kingdom versus what it means to be a chimpanzee or a lion? So some theologians, Christopher Southgate, for example, would say that there will still be some sort of hunting in heaven. That there, you know, that if you take those instincts and those abilities away from a lion, you just don't have a lion anymore. And so he has some idea that there will be this ongoing relationship between, say, the lion and the gazelle or the lion and the lamb that is predatory but is stripped of the things that are painful, that cause suffering. I've taken a slightly different turn from that, and I think that in the new creation, all those instincts will be perfected in a different way. So if we think of humans, we developed a whole bunch of instincts and a whole bunch of skills that were very useful for hunting, and now we use them in sport, right? So we've taken the same skills that we needed for one thing and changed them to a peaceable activity. So I think that there might be something like, you know, not quite lion squash in heaven, but some way that those instincts are preserved without the predatory nature of the relationship. When I'm trying to be poetic, I say that they will, you know, be in full pursuit of God with all their instincts and abilities, and that the chase of the lion will be after God.
Will a chimp still be able to kill another chimp and not commit sin?
Well, a chimp, I don't, my hope would be that a chimp wouldn't want to kill another chimp.
Okay.
So those inner desires would be changed. Yeah. Casting out into the utterly speculative.
Let's see
one, two back. More, and then we're done?
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me that an implication of your proposal is calling for a very universal scope for salvation. And I share many sympathies with this position. Now, I'm wondering, with regard to eschatology, how do you reconcile? Is it all kinds of creatures, or is it all creatures?
I think it's all creatures. Because the definition of love is so particular to the individual, because God has a shared history with every creature that has ever been, you can't just say, oh, well, you know, have one beetle and that'll be enough,
yeah.
Because God has shared a particular relationship with every beetle.
Yeah.
And I don't think eschatologically we'll be faced by questions of lack of space or lack of resources.
So in Revelation, when the heavens and the earth become one, is that a big crunch, opposite of the Big Bang?
No, I mean, that's apocalyptic literature,
okay.
And it's,
you're not worried about space. Like,
no.
I'm always given feedback with regard to dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And those pesky mosquitoes as well. Why would God say mosquitoes?
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, C.S. Lewis points out that a heaven for mosquitoes and a hell for people could be very helpfully combined.
Thank you for allowing us to think through this. My real question, more of a clarification I'm seeking from you, is when you made a distinction, as it were, between God intentionally making creation itself the way it was, even with the violence, separating that from the fall of man. And so how do you reconcile that with, say, Romans 8, verse 19? I'll read that quickly, 19 to 21. It says, "For all creation is waiting eagerly for the future day when God will reveal who his children really are. Against its will, all creation is subjected to God's curse. But with eager hope, the creation looks forward to the day when it will join God's children in glorious freedom from death and decay."
Yeah.
So how would you interpret that as, because in this case, it appeared as though Paul was looking at this event, all of creation and human beings, to the fore. At the beginning of this decay and curse, and therefore looking forward to redemption, which you rightfully refer to in the future. So Paul didn't seem to make that separation.
So there are various ways to approach that, and it's a hugely complex and a very, very good question. The first thing would be to say that the reason that I take the view I do is because I know about evolution. I know about a long history for the earth. I know about how this competition brings new life and diversity about. Paul didn't know those things. So Paul, as an ancient thinker, would have been communicating inside the culture that he lived in. And that did point back to Adam and the fall. He did speak out of Revelation, but he also spoke in a particular culture. So he spoke Greek and not English, for example. And so in the same way that we have to accommodate for a language translation, we have to also deal with a cultural translation. And Paul's view of death in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15 is also ambiguous. So he says things like, death entered the world through you know, one man. But in that same passage, he's saying, I die every day, brothers, I mean it, you know, or I'm crucified with Christ and I myself no longer live, right? So his view of death is not unambiguously meaning physical death. And there are ways in which we can talk about the whole creation being brought into this groaning without saying that it itself has fallen. So if you imagine creation as sort of a symphony playing, and you have one rogue section, the trumpets decide they're not going to do what everyone else is doing, and they're going off and playing six different things, everybody else in that orchestra is going to be groaning in real reality, even if they're still following the script, even if they're still following the music. And I think that's what humans have done. And so there is a sense in which all of creation is looking forward to this redemption that will come when humans are redeemed. And so I I think Paul was saying something slightly different to what I've just put forward, but I think it's a helpful way that we can recapture the feeling of that verse, the theological intent of that verse, in a different situation that looks at the history of evolution. Thank you.
Maybe I'm not so good now.